Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Every year, nearly 800,000 Americans have a stroke, and about 15% of them die from the condition. For those who survive, rehabilitation is hard work, physically, mentally, and emotionally. An Ohio State University research team has devised a promising new therapy regimen for stroke survivors, one you can do at home, and one that you could almost call fun. Anyone can try it out at the Ross Heart Hospital lobby on the OSU campus, where there will be free stroke risk assessments on Thursdays throughout the month of May. For more information about the free assessments, go to the link at our website at wosu.org/allsides. Joining us now to tell us more is Assistant Professor of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation, Lynn Gauthier. Welcome to the show, Lynn.
Thank you.
So what is the traditional stroke rehabilitation like? What skills or functioning are people typically trying to regain?
Well, that would depend on what part of the brain was affected by the stroke and what kinds of challenges they're experiencing after the stroke. My lab in particular works on motor rehabilitation. So oftentimes after a stroke, people have difficulty moving the arm and the hand or their leg on that side of the body.
And what's traditional stroke rehabilitation like? Let's just take the an arm or a leg. What do people do now to rehabilitate?
Usually they get, right after the stroke, they usually get some sort of inpatient rehabilitation where they'll get occupational or physical therapy. And then oftentimes people go to a rehab center, which would be they're there for about 2 or 3 weeks getting more intensive rehab about 3 hours a day. And then after that, people are discharged home and then typically only get 1 to 2 hours a week of outpatient rehab in an outpatient clinic.
Is the outpatient aspect of it a problem? Why this new strategy?
Well, one of the problems that we're trying to address is the fact that after people discharge from the inpatient rehab, they're really not getting the intensity of rehab that they need to make, rapid and meaningful changes to their motor function. So oftentimes progress is very slow, or they're not even getting therapy at all. So what we're trying to address in the game is to provide a treatment that people can access that would give them the same kind of intensive motor practice that they get in an inpatient setting, but from the comfort of their own homes.
Is that also more affordable?
Our goal is to make it affordable for folks because we're using a commercial product, the Microsoft Kinect camera. So it's a video game sensor, and it costs about $200 and plugs into the computer.
Okay.
So our goal is by using a commercially available product and not some specialty equipment that it can be easily accessible to folks and affordable.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest this hour is assistant professor at OSU, Lynn Gauthier. We're talking about a new regimen for rehabilitation from stroke. If you have a question or comment for Lynn Gauthier, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So you and your team developed a video game that patients can use as at-home physical therapy. What does it help? Tell us how it works.
So the game works by recording the person's body motion. So like I mentioned, the sensor that we use is the Microsoft Kinect. And as a person moves their hand and arm, the camera records their motions, and an avatar in the game environment moves the same way that the person is moving. So they can see how their hand and arm is moving in the game as they're playing the game. And all that's required to play the game is the body movements.
What do you know about why playing a game helps?
Well, we know that what's called masked practice is very important after someone has a stroke as far as regaining motor function. So by masked practice, I mean intensive rehab, doing a motion over and over and over again. So we know that it's important to create new connections in the brain to make up for areas of the brain that are damaged by the stroke. And to create these new connections, you need that repetition. People just don't get enough of that in a standard outpatient setting because they go there, you know, a couple of hours a week. And that's just not enough practice. It's not enough time to get that amount of practice. So what we're trying to do through the game is provide an opportunity where they can do many, many, many movements over and over and over again and, you know, have the game be a fun way to do that. We know from folks who've played the game in our clinical trials that people are getting on average about 1,500 movements per hour by playing the game.
Versus?
In a standard clinical setting, they do about 110.
So per you're hour. Turning them into gaming junkies.
Well, I don't know that anyone's been addicted, but I think folks have generally enjoyed the experience.
But it's the idea that they get to play a game while they're doing it.
Yes.
And gaming can be is a big attraction. People like to do it.
Mm-hmm. And folks have said that the time goes by quicker when they're playing a game as opposed to just doing.
Yeah. What gave you the idea to do that?
Well, we've been looking for ways to make rehab accessible to folks. And that's been a big thing that's been on my mind because only about 1% of people are able to get this effective motor treatment. It's called constraint-induced movement therapy, and it's just not available to folks. So I've been thinking about ways to make it more accessible to people who can't otherwise get it. And then when the Microsoft Kinect came out, because it's a sensor that you can play a game with just your body movements, it seemed like the perfect way to deliver this therapy to people, you know, at a lower cost and to make it accessible to folks. So we weren't specifically looking to go in that direction, but because it came out, you know, it just seemed like such a good application for rehab, and it seemed like a way that we could make this therapy accessible.
Now, anyone can drop by the Ross Heart Hospital tomorrow in the lobby between 10 and 2 and try out the video game, right?
Yes.
Okay. But give us a sense of what the game is like. Is it, you know, is it a Grand Theft Auto? Is it, what kind of game is it?
So the game we designed is, it's called Recovery Rapids, and it's kind of a kayak adventure game. So the person is on a river and they're paddling a kayak. You know, to move the boat forward, they paddle their paretic arm into the water. And then there's obstacles that come in their way along the river. So they have to do different motor movements to get rid of the obstacles and to collect things from the water. One section of the game, they fish. So they've got a net and they scoop, you know, it works the elbow by scooping the net into the water to catch fish. In another section of the game, there's bats that attack them in a cave. So they have to swat away the bats. They have to pick things off of bushes, have to steer around rocks and rapids so that they don't crash their boat. So there's a number of different things they can collect along the river.
If you have a question for my guest, Lynn Gauthier, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Wexner Medical Center's stroke program is offering free stroke assessment screenings on Thursdays in May. What do those assessments consist of?
So I assume that they're going to test the person's blood pressure because we know that high blood pressure is a risk factor for stroke. They probably will also ask if the person is a smoker because we know that smoking is also another strong risk factor for stroke. I don't know if they're going to be checking cholesterol levels or blood sugar, but those are also risk factors and something they might be assessing for.
And what, as far as this video game goes, what have the results been so far? How do you measure the success of this?
Well, we give people a comprehensive motor battery. So we give them tests of their hand and arm functioning before they play the game. And we repeat those tests again after they have their game in their house for a period of 2 weeks. We ask the person to play the game for 30 hours over that time. And so far, we've promising results. In terms of motor speed, which is an outcome that's very important to stroke survivors, we see results that are at least comparable to constraint-induced movement therapy, the kind of the gold standard therapy that this game is based off of. So we're seeing promising results so far.
Are there other strategies that you're looking at going forward?
What do you mean by
well, the game? There's the game, the video game idea. Are there other kinds of games out there that you're working on to expand the repertoire?
Not yet. We're focusing most of our efforts on just this one game to try to get it out to the public as quickly as possible. In the future, we're going to be hoping to do a randomized controlled trial that compares the video game delivery of constraint-induced movement therapy to the standard one-on-one with a therapist version of constraint-induced movement therapy to get a sense of how the two compare head-to-head.
And how are you getting it out to people?
We're working right now with the tech commercialization office to try to get entrepreneurs that might be interested in licensing the technology. And then we can hopefully they will take it to market. We are also pursuing the option of potentially open sourcing the product. So we're kind of getting a feel for, you know, how we're going to get this out. But it's something that we're spending quite a bit of effort towards.
Jerry, you're on the air. Hi, Jerry. Hello, Jerry.
My wife of 62 years from a hemorrhagic stroke last September, and I have a dear friend and former associate who's 88, and he had a stroke, and the whole left side is paralyzed. He's been in Mayfield Village for about 7 years. I visit him every chance I can get. But anyway, are you familiar with the book Stroke Diaries? Survivors and Their Families by Dr. O. Williams.
I have not read that.
Well, he brings out in that book that there is a procedure that if you can get to it within 45 minutes of the stroke happening, which is doggone hard to do, as we know, but you can stop the thing from going 100%. Hmm. And it is an excellent book, and I was going to ask if there's any hospitals in Columbus that have doctors that are familiar with that procedure, because if I ever have a stroke, I'll call them.
Okay. Let's see what Lynn Gauthier has to say. Yep.
So the procedure you're probably referring to is the administration of what's called RTPA, and that's a drug that they can give if the person is having an ischemic stroke, so a blood clot that's blocking a blood vessel to the brain. And this does, like you mentioned, it does have to be administered within the first couple of hours after a person has a stroke. Most major medical centers would be able to administer that drug, but it's certainly advantageous to go to a medical center that has kind of a comprehensive stroke program, or one that's very familiar with how to treat stroke, as they will be able to figure out who's a good candidate for that drug.
Okay, Jerry, thanks a lot for that call. And Kevin in Grove City, you're on the air. You've tried the game.
Yeah, how you doing? Now, I've witnessed the game, and I've met Lynn, Dr. Gauthier and her team, and I've seen it demonstrated, and it's just tremendous, and I encourage anyone who suffered a stroke and has the challenges of rehabilitating to take advantage of this technology. Her team really gets it. There's a lot of therapists out there that go through the motions of just the standard way of rehabilitation, but Lynn and her team have a very earthy, grounded view of rehabilitation, and I'm really excited to have met them.
All right, Kevin, thanks for your call.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Is this something you can play with other people?
Unfortunately, not right at the moment. We would like to make a social element to the game, but that requires a lot of further development, and we just don't have the resources as researchers to do it. But we are hoping that, you know, maybe if a company does license it, they might be interested in pursuing that option, because we know that would be meaningful to quite a few folks.
Well, Lynn Gauthier, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Dr. Lynn Gauthier, she's assistant professor of physical medicine rehabilitations. And once again, you can see more about the video game she's been talking about to help with rehabilitation from stroke tomorrow at the Ross Heart Hospital lobby from 10 to 2. Just check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. Wellness Wednesday and All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. Parents who care know that the more they care about what their kids eat, the harder it can be to get them to eat what they are served. And if you're a typical busy parent, you probably struggle to feed yourself properly. Here to help us navigate through the dilemmas of dinner is dietitian and author of a new book on the topic, Dinner Time Survival Guide, Sally Kuzemchak. Welcome to the show, Sally.
Thanks for having me.
So why dinner? Why not breakfast and lunch too?
Well, that's funny. Well, dinner is the time for families when most of them come together finally at the end of the day. Breakfast may be a crazy rush. Kids may be eating lunch at school, but finally at dinner, everyone's there. Everyone's waiting. What is for dinner? They're looking at the parent, and finally everyone's around the table. So it's a fabulous opportunity, but unfortunately, it's also can be super stressful. All these things are sort of conspiring against you to get the meal on the table. So it can be really tough.
You are not always a skilled and enthusiastic cook, but you're a dietitian.
Yes.
What changed your approach?
What do you mean?
Well, what made you want to become a more, I mean, was it just from having children?
Sure. Oh, yes. Having kids changed everything. And so I talk in the book about how pre-kids, my husband and I would just spend all this time together cooking and talking, and we would actually carry our plates out and watch TV at like 8:30. And then all of a sudden we had kids, and it was like, okay, not only do I need to step it up as far as having a square meal on the table, but all this has to start at 5 or 5:30. And it just was a lot more challenging. And now that I had kids at the table who are looking to me for, you know, learning how to eat, learning to try new foods, it was just a whole different experience. And so hopefully this book really speaks to that.
You present in the book 10 dinner time dilemmas, mm-hmm. Dozens of solutions and recipes. It's a very colorful book. It's fun to read. Let's start with one common problem, and that you've already mentioned it. It's a lack of time. A lot of people get home late. They can't begin to prepare a meal, mm-hmm. Or they could, but they don't want their kids eating at 9 o'clock at night.
Right.
So what do you suggest?
Well, there are a few things you can do. First of all, meal planning is absolutely essential. And for a lot of parents, this can sort of feel like a chore and one that they would rather sort of take off the to-do list. But really about 5-10 minutes at the beginning of the week to meal plan, and then you go shopping. After you have your meal plan, you go shopping, you have everything. Maybe you post that meal plan in your kitchen somewhere where everyone can see it, can really set you on track for the whole week to have a lot more success. Another thing you can do is do things in advance. So say you have 5 or 10 minutes in the morning, but maybe you get up a little bit earlier before the kids do. You could chop an onion. You could mix up a marinade. You could toss together some breadcrumbs for a breading. Or, you know, when your baby's down for a nap, you can do those same things. So when dinner time comes, that sort of crazy scramble at 5:30, you have some of that ready that you can pull out, and it takes 5-10 minutes off. And that can make all the difference in the world when you're those 5 to 10 minutes. When you're having that crazy dinner scramble.
A lot of people really fall into the trap of just getting fast food all the time.
Yeah.
And you're not totally down on getting takeout. Mm-hmm. You say get the roasted chicken at the grocery store.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I'm a realist, so I'm not going to tell you never go through the drive-thru, never pick up takeout. That's just not realistic for families. But I will say that some parents feel like that is their only option to go through that drive-thru, and it's not. As a dietitian, I really feel like even if you come home and you make sandwiches for everyone, that is a lot healthier and better for your kids and cheaper in the long run than going out and getting some kind of greasy takeout. The last chapter of this book is called Frankly, I Don't Feel Like It, about just not wanting to cook. And so we have really low effort recipes in there, a lot of sandwiches, things that actually don't even require pots and pans on the stove, so they don't sort of feel like cooking. But you'll be so much happier when you're clearing away those dishes after you've served those sandwiches or simple pasta or whatever than if you're sort of, you know, taking the greasy pizza box and throwing it away.
My guest is Sally Kuzemchak. She is author of a new book. It's called Dinner Time Survival Guide. She's a Columbus resident. She's right here in the studio. If you have a question or comment, have any ideas, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. You laid out some rules for dining with children, and they're maybe not what we'd expect. For example, you say not to force your kids to try everything on the plate. I definitely come from that generation where we were forced to eat everything, and my parents were children of the Depression and that kind of a thing, and they were appalled at how we would turn away food. But all things being equal, why not force your kids to at least try everything?
Well, you know, and this strategy of asking kids or requiring kids to try things, that may work for some children. With our first child, it worked. We would say, you need to at least take one bite. And he would. He was a very obedient child. My second kid totally backfired, and he dug his heels in even more. And it made the whole dinner time environment stressful and negative. And that's absolutely what you don't want at the dinner table. So with him, I scrapped that you have to try everything rule. And now it's just you can try it or you don't. And the food is presented in a very threatening, there's no pressure. And I think that when kids have that choice and they're given the freedom, they're much happier at the table and they're much more willing and receptive to try things than if you're saying you can't leave the table until you eat this or, you know, you have to clean your plate before you get dessert. That's another, I think, big mistake that many parents make.
Jason in Washington, D.C. Hi, Jason. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I just had a question about just related to a 3-year-old. He's gotten increasingly picky about what he eats and almost irrational. And I wanted to know, how do you tell your children on, as you guys were talking about earlier, just trying new things or even negotiating with them? I guess you don't really negotiate, but what are some of the recipes in the book that you could recommend that would sort of introduce kids to maybe some of the trickier vegetables or trickier items on the dinner table?
Sure. So with the recipes, I always say, so my big rule for this book is you make one meal. So you do not make 5 different meals and take requests. So you make one meal. That being said, you can also deconstruct it. So say you're making a dish that's pasta and chicken and vegetables all tossed together with some kind of sauce. I see nothing wrong with making the components of that meal and presenting them separately for that 3-year-old, or having it set up in sort of a bar situation. So you have your pasta, your protein, your vegetables, and letting that child build that meal.
Sometimes they don't like it all mixed together.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's okay. That may come with time, it may not, but be patient with your kids. Always have something on the table you know your child likes. So if you're serving hamburgers, you know your child doesn't like those, make sure that there's a side dish, maybe some fruit, maybe some vegetables that you know your kids reliably eat. So when they come to the table, it's a welcoming place for them too.
Jason, thanks a lot for your call.
That's a really cool idea.
Okay.
Thank you.
Take care. You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. If you have a question or comment for our dietitian / cookbook author / mealtime, saver, she's the author. The name of her book is called Cooking Light, Dinnertime Survival Guide. Her name is Sally Kazemchak, and she's here to take your questions, 614-292-8513. That no special request thing, mom is not, or whoever's cooking dinner, I should say, Jason or mom or whoever it is not a short order cook. Why is that important?
Well, first of all, being a short order cook is extremely stressful on the parent who is making the meal, and it's hard enough to pull together one dinner, much less 3 or 4. And I think kids need to learn to try and accept new foods or make do with foods that maybe aren't their favorite, but they're hungry and the parent made it, and it's time for dinner. It's time for the family to come and share in that. So I don't think children will ever be encouraged to try new things or to eat those maybe less than favorite foods if you're always catering them and making them the chicken nuggets or the peanut butter sandwich. There's no opportunity there to grow.
Martha in Columbus. Welcome to the show, Martha.
Hi. I have a real dilemma because I have not only a picky child, but a very picky husband. And I am a short order cook. I made 3 different meals last night. And I am dying to find out where I can get your book and if you have some recipes. We've had the conversation about how important this is, and, you know, but he literally grew up eating McDonald's. He says that to everyone. And so anything outside of fish sticks and tater tots is kind of over the top for him.
Martha, I think your question or your experience is probably a lot more common than you think. Right, Sally? Mm-hmm.
Definitely. So to answer her first question, the book is on Amazon.com. It's actually on sale right now.
And you can probably find it.
Barnes & Noble, anywhere books are sold. Yeah. Yes, and I actually address this in the book with the spouses because it is something that I hear a lot. And I think what's very important when you have children is to make sure your spouse is on board with how you want to feed the family. So I have heard of families where the one spouse will bring something to the table and the other spouse will make a disparaging comment about it or say, I'm not eating that. I'm going to go get a pizza. And absolutely, you've got to get on the same page with this or it's sending a terrible message to your kids. So, you know, I think that the family needs, in that case, needs to work together to look through cookbooks, go online, look at recipes that will please them all, even if it's deconstructed. So maybe the husband won't like every aspect of that meal, but maybe he can take parts and pieces of it. So for instance, my husband doesn't like all the vegetables I serve. So if he doesn't like that particular vegetable, I may give him a small portion and give him a big salad. But it's known that we're all eating vegetables at the table.
Okay, Martha, good luck. Deb in Westerville, you're on the air. Hi, Deb.
Hi. Not to sound like a prima donna or anything, but my son doesn't know anything else but good food. We've always offered him just, you know, fruits and vegetables and that kind of stuff since he was a baby. So he just, you know, assumes that's how you eat. And I make him lunch the same way all the time. But my problem is that I eat a lot of junk food. So I find myself doing that on the side, like a secret agent or something. And I don't know. I mean, maybe that's a good thing. My husband does the same thing. We just kind of go off to McDonald's by ourselves and indulge when we have to. Is that strange or what?
I don't think that's strange at all. My husband and I have been known to have a bowl of ice cream when we put the kids to bed. And occasionally one of our children has gotten up in the middle, you know, at 10 o'clock and come down and been like, what are you guys doing? Is this what you do when we go to bed? So... But there is a chapter in the book about, you know, if you are trying to eat, it's called I'm on a Diet, My Family's Not. That's what that chapter is called. And it is about if you want to really improve your habits, maybe you are trying to lose weight. How do you do that when you have a family who maybe they want macaroni and cheese, you know, every night? So, I mean, that's kind of
reverse
of what's going on. But, you know, I think that the habits that you want your kids to have are things that you should, and you are the most powerful role model for your kids. So, hey, I totally understand occasionally sneaking, but obviously, you know, as your kids get older and wiser, they may pick up on that. So,
yeah, when are you going to come out to them, Deb?
He's able to notice there's certain things in the fridge I can't hide anymore.
Right. Yeah, that's what my dad up. And his Verners. Right. Deb, thanks a lot for your call.
Yeah.
Take care. Oh, Jim in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Jim.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I made a comment when I called in that I think this system, this world today, spoils your kids. Now, I'm not talking about little kids that are, you know, in a crib or growing up. But when mine were up and walking and all that, I wasn't a restaurant. And so I fixed a meal. The kid sat down to the meal. If the kid said, I don't like that, you know, then we would say, fine, you know, breakfast is in the morning, you know,
right.
Or the next meal. And it ended up, by the time they were in their teenage years, you couldn't put anything in front of them that they would not eat.
I mean, that's kind of what you were saying is don't give them a choice. Don't force them, but don't give them a choice.
Yeah. And you know, but do that with kindness as well. So if you're serving something, you know, my kids, neither of them like salmon. So if I were to serve salmon, I would make sure that there were other things on the table that they would want to eat. And I do talk I think every parent has had that experience of serving something they know their kids like, and their kids for some reason say, I don't like this. I don't want this. And you just feel like you're going to pull out your hair. And I talk in the book about how kind of our dinner time rule is if you don't finish your meal, we wrap it up. We put some plastic wrap over it and put it in the fridge. So invariably 40 minutes later, when they come back and say, we're hungry, I can say, here's your meal. I'm happy to heat it up for you. It's not a punishment. It's just, you know, I know this is food that you'll like. And if you don't want it, that's okay. But as the caller said, you could have a big breakfast tomorrow morning.
Right,
that's
big breakfast tomorrow morning.
House rule.
Jim, thanks for that call. We have an email from Sherry. She says, during Little League baseball season, we don't get home until around 8 p.m. when it's already time to get the kids ready for bed. Mm. What kinds of healthy meals can we eat on the go, in the car, et cetera, that can be carried with us all day so we don't get to stop home, as we don't get to stop home first? Very common problem.
Extremely common. I have this as well. In fact, tonight is one of those nights for me. So we have a whole chapter on that. And there are meals that you could, for instance, pack up as a tailgate picnic. So you can, you know, make sandwiches and wraps and take them with you. You know, pack a little cooler in the minivan, take it with you to the Little League field. There are also some great recipes that are slow cooker recipes. There's a great slow cooker lasagna that I love, and it takes about three and a half hours. So you can make that when the kids get home from dinner, set the timer, go out to the activities. When you come back at 8, all you have to do is throw together, you know, take a bagged salad out of the fridge, take the lasagna out, it's steaming, it's hot, it's ready. So you could also, you know, adjust your mealtime a little later to have that slow cooker meal ready.
And that's in the book.
It is, yes.
Anne in Columbus, you've read the book. Hi, Anne.
Yes, I have, and I'm a huge fan of Cooking Light, and the pictures are fabulous, mm-hmm. and everything's easy, and it actually tells you how many minutes things will take. I've tried a couple of the recipes, and they're wonderful. It actually has some humor in it, too, so mm-hmm. I love it. But also, I noticed that my kids were coming home from school and snacking, and then I'd have dinner, and they wouldn't eat it. So I realized starving them a little bit helps them eat the meal. Like, I'll say, no snacks right now, and then they actually started eating the meal. But I now serve dinner earlier. Mm-hmm. I have that luxury. I'm a stay-at-home mom, but I noticed that if I didn't have dinner ready when they came home from school, they kind of didn't. They picked at dinner, so that helped me get that, you know, nourishing dinner in, and then I'll let them snack later on.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, they eat the dinner, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I also noticed that after a big party, we had just a crudité plate, and now I keep one at all times, just in case I can't get to, like, cooked vegetables or something.
Really
I
smart.
Pull out just a dinner plate that I section off and throw some carrots and broccoli and have a little dish of dip, and that's easy to grab if I haven't prepared, you know, some kind of side. Just to always have that plate in there to go and set in the middle of the table. And actually, that's my go-to all the time now.
Yeah, that's a super smart idea. And I talk in the book about how at my house in the hour before dinner is served, so in my house, that's about 5 to 6. The rule is if you're hungry, you can snack on veggies. Otherwise, no snacks. So it's nice because your kids still come to the table hungry. And if they've snacked on veggies, you don't feel this pressure at dinner, like, oh, they've got to get their vegetables mm-hmm. in at dinner mm-hmm. because they've been munching on carrots and celery and broccoli for the last hour. So for me, that works. And so I think that's a great strategy.
Anne, thank you for that call. Sally Kazemchak, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Sally Kazemchak, she's the author of a new book. It's called Cooking Light, Dinnertime Survival Guide. Coming up, we're going to be talking about news in health and wellness. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Sure, it's trendy, and sure, it delivers tons of vitamins A, C, and K, but kale's tough, bitter leaves can be hard for some to swallow. Joining us now with some tips on how to dress kale up and a host of other health news is the chair of the editorial board of the UC Berkeley School of Public Health Wellness Letter, Dr. John Swartzberg. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
So, do you have a sense about why kale has gotten to be so popular? Where you are in Northern California, it must be huge.
It is huge here, and I don't have a sense, but it really is popular, and it's been popular for a while now. Actually, we've been eating it at home quite a bit, and it's a nice vegetable to eat.
I prefer young kale, you know, baby kale, but what are its health benefits?
Well, it really is a very healthy vegetable. It's in the same family as broccoli and Brussels sprouts. It's particularly high in vitamin K, which is good for bones. It has a moderate amount of beta-carotene, which our bodies convert to vitamin A, so that's helpful. It has potassium, manganese, lots of fiber, iron, magnesium. So it's got a lot of nutrients, and it's really got a lot of nutrients for very few calories. There are just 35 calories in a typical 4.5-ounce serving. So it's a very healthy vegetable.
Now, are there any cautions for eating kale? Is it good for anybody?
Well, I think the only real big caution is if people are on a blood thinner called warfarin. The typical brand name is Coumadin.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the large amount of vitamin K in kale, it could interfere with the action of the blood thinner. So if you're taking that drug, please speak with your doctor about eating kale.
And I like to saute it myself, but some people like to steam it. What are the best ways to prepare kale, in your opinion?
Well, there are a lot of ways to prepare it. I particularly like it in soup because it serves two purposes. One is it adds a nice taste, and the other is that it makes it a lot easier to eat in terms of the toughness of kale.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the thing that people complain about the most, that it can be really tough. One thing that helps is marinating it for about 30 minutes or so. That makes it softer. Some people massage it. They actually rub it down. And cutting it up fairly fine helps too. Younger kale tends to be a lot less tough than older kale.
Mm-hmm. And people who don't like the taste, some people think it tastes very bitter.
Well, it can be dressed up. You put it in salad with dressing, as I mentioned, with soup, and so that gets rid of some of the taste. A lot of manufacturers are getting onto the bandwagon of kale, and they're producing kale chips and kale dips and so on. Be careful with those because they add a lot of other calories, additional calories, as well as a lot of fat. So it may take away some of the benefits from kale.
But it's easy to make chips at home.
It is easy to make chips at home, and we've done that, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Use a little olive oil, sprinkle some garlic powder or cayenne or other seasonings on it, put it in the oven, 375, until it's crisp. I really like that.
I do, too. Now, not everybody eats foods that are very nutrient-rich like kale, so let's turn to the topic of multivitamins. How do you know if you're a candidate for a multivitamin?
Yeah, well, it's a great experiment on the American public that so many Americans are taking a multivitamin with very, very little evidence of benefit and, frankly, very, very little evidence of safety. So we're going to find out the consequences of this in the future. The problem in the past has been that there have not been a lot of good studies on who would benefit from vitamins. Until recently, there were a couple of studies that we reported on in our May issue, one in the Annals of Internal Medicine that looked at 6,000 health professional males who were all 65 and over, and there was no benefit to taking multivitamin in terms of cognitive performance after 10 years. There was another study that was published through the National Institute of Health that looked at almost 2,000 people, and they found very little benefit to taking multivitamins, actually multivitamins designed by complementary and alternative medical practitioners, but they found no benefit in taking them for cardiovascular protection. These were controlled, double-blinded studies, so they're the best we have.
Mm-hmm.
So our bottom line was, for everybody, no. But there are some people who we still think should be taking multivitamins. One is if you're pregnant or thinking about becoming pregnant, to make sure you're taking a multivitamin, and that's mainly because of the folic acid. There's overwhelming data that folic acid in women who get pregnant will help prevent what we call neural tube defects, a devastating problem in newborns. So that's very important. There's pretty good data if you're pregnant or breastfeeding to be taking a multi, but you should check with your obstetrician about that. If you're a strict vegetarian, you're probably not going to get enough vitamin B12, zinc, iron, calcium. And so that's a group that probably should take a multi. And if you're on a prolonged weight loss diet, it probably is a good idea to supplement your diet with that. But frankly, for people who are otherwise in good health and eat a healthy diet, there's really no reason to be taking a multi. And even there's no good data that even if you're not on a particularly healthy diet, that a multi is going to do you any good. There's just a lack of data there.
What do we know about why that is? So you're taking a vitamin, you're taking a vitamin to replace what you may not be getting even in your diet. Is there something, why doesn't it help? Do we know?
Well, I think the reason it doesn't is because when we discovered vitamins, and then this is very early in the 20th century, uh-huh. And then when we discovered what are called vitamin deficiency diseases like scurvy and vitamin C, uh-huh. It was thought that vitamins were just going to solve all of our problems. And they clearly solve the problems of vitamin deficiency diseases. But in the United States today and in the developed world today, vitamin deficiency diseases are pretty much unheard of in a healthy population. So the multivitamins have just not been able to be shown to be effective in a population that has access to food. Now, that said, we know in the United States there's still a large swath of people who go hungry every day. But unfortunately, these are the same people who can't afford to take even a multivitamin for pennies every day.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned briefly that the jury's still out on whether or not vitamins could be harmful to some people.
Well, it is still out. And the reason it's still out is because it's very hard to do a large enough study to demonstrate either benefit or harm. And so the United States Preventive Services Task Force came out recently with a statement saying that there is insufficient science to say that vitamins are helpful or can harm you.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest this segment, Dr. John Swartzberg of the editorial board of the UC Berkeley School of Public Health Wellness Letter. If you have a question or comment for Dr. Swartzberg, give us a call, 614-292-8513. And Jared in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Jared.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Yeah, I just had a quick question. About allergies, because I have a dairy allergy. So I've had some people say, well, you should be taking calcium supplements because you're probably not getting as much calcium as other people. You're not eating cheese, you're not eating yogurt or whatever. I've done that and I haven't really noticed a difference, but I'm also pretty young. I don't know what you think about that, or is that beneficial for somebody in my situation in the long run? Is there, effects that I might feel later on and be glad that I took supplements like that, or is that kind of the same as what you're talking about with the multivitamins, probably not going to do much in the long run?
Dr. Swartzberg, thank you, Jared. That's a good question.
It's a great question. Thank you. Calcium supplementation is almost a separate topic. And tied with calcium supplementation is vitamin D, so let's chat briefly about both of those. You should pay attention to how much calcium you're getting. And the easiest way to get it, as you mentioned, Jared, is getting it through milk products. But we were talking about kale earlier, and that has quite a bit of calcium in it. So take a look at other foods that you may like that you could boost your calcium intake. If you don't think you're getting enough calcium, which for a young man is probably going to be around 1,000 to 1,200 milligrams a day, some people say 800 is sufficient, so in that range per day, then you might consider taking a calcium supplement. There's been some debate about calcium supplements recently. Researchers in New Zealand have published several papers raising the question that calcium supplements, as opposed to calcium in food, can accelerate atherosclerosis, hardening of the arteries. Mm-hmm. But since then, there have been many papers that have refuted that, so we don't think that's a real big concern. But I think the best advice is to aim for getting adequate calcium through your diet. One trick you might use if you're lactase deficient, you can buy lactose-free milk, and that would be easy to digest. Another thing you can do is yogurt. Many people who are lactase deficient can tolerate yogurt. And you should make sure you get adequate vitamin D, and that's hard to get without supplementation, so do pay attention to that as well.
Okay, Jared, thanks a lot for your call. Are there nutrients that we're better off getting from food than pills?
I think as a blanket statement, Anne, it's always better, you're always better off to get your nutrients through food than through supplements. There are so many things in foods and the combinations of those things in foods that we still don't understand. But we know that eating fruits, vegetables, primarily a diet based on fruits and vegetables and whole grains, is an extremely healthy diet. We don't know that taking supplements is an extremely healthful strategy.
Let's turn to telomeres. Is that how I pronounce it?
That's a good way to pronounce it.
Telomeres. you know, I bet a lot of us have been lured into taking one of those real age quizzes online or on Facebook. They ask us health questions and calculate how much longer we have to live, I guess, basically. But there's another way that's more scientific to judge biological age by looking at our telomeres. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. Yeah, this has been a recent marketing craze about your actual age and whether telomeres can help us understand that. What telomeres are there these it's genetic material that are essentially caps on the end of our DNA. And what we found, and actually some researchers just recently won the Nobel Prize for this, what we found is that these telomeres get shorter and shorter and shorter as we age. And there's some question now as to whether this could correlate with aging. That is, is there something about shortening telomeres that really has an effect on our aging, or is this what we call a surrogate marker, or just a marker that doesn't reflect that? And we don't know the answer to that yet. But it is true that as we age, our telomeres get shorter. So some companies have tried to market this and say that we can check and see how long your telomeres are, and this will determine how old you really are biologically as opposed to chronologically.
So what are some ways we can keep our telomeres nice and long? I mean, is there something we can do?
Well, this is a new science, and so everything I'm going to say now is should be framed from the perspective that we're still learning a great deal about telomeres. Mm-hmm. That said, a diet that's very, very low in fat and plant-based, this is called the Dean Ornish diet, was shown that after 5 years, people who ate a diet like that had longer telomeres than those who didn't. There was an Italian study that showed that people who had a diet that was particularly high in beta-carotene and antioxidants, a diet, not supplements, mm-hmm. had longer telomeres than those that didn't. There was another study that showed that psychological stress can have an effect on telomeres, and people who had long-term depression had shorter telomeres, so psychotherapy or maybe medication. There's a lot, actually several studies showing smoking shortens your telomeres. Exercise tends to make them longer. So there was a reasonable study that showed that people who exercised regularly, no one knows how much, mm-hmm. have longer telomeres than people who don't. So those are some things we can do. A healthy diet, exercise, take care of your mental health. But, you know, these are things that we should be doing anyway.
We already know this.
Exactly. So I don't think you need to pay money to some company to get told how long your telomeres are. You just need to follow basic advice.
Okay. Real quick, we just have about a minute left, but I wanted to talk about water and the flavored water powders and additives on the market. A lot of them say zero calories, no added sugar. Are these better than, say, Diet Cola, at least, or Diet Soda?
Oh, they may be better than Diet Cola, or they may not. To make them sweet, the bottled products have sweeteners in them, and if you don't want to eat those sweeteners, then they're no better than Diet Colas. They won't have the phosphates in them, which may be a problem with the Diet Colas. Hmm. So there are some advantages to them. Okay. There are ways you can do it really at home that are free, are essentially free. You can put fruit in them yourselves, grate some ginger if you want, or
lemon lime.
Lemon lime, exactly. Hmm. Just make your own and don't spend the money buying the products.
Well, that is all we have time for. I could just sit in here and talk to you all day, Dr. Swartzberg. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome. It's always fun.
Dr. John Swartzberg, he's chair of the editorial board of the UC Berkeley School of Public Health Wellness Letter. Thanks for listening today on Wellness Wednesday. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.